Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you ever want more info on anything you hear on our show, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more on our guests, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. But right now, let's get to this week's show, hosted by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Now today, we are laser focused on making this season a lot easier and a lot more fun for you. To help this year, those master cooks and culinary thinkers at America's Test Kitchen are going to be with us. So put your feet up and relax. We have your back with a slew of ways to enjoy your own parties, nail ideal gifts, how to loosen up and freshen up your table with conversation, and easy ways to cook like a pro. With that mission in mind, Bridget Lancaster joins us. She's the host of America's Test Kitchen television show. Hey, Bridget, it's good to have you with us.
It's fabulous to be here.
Well, Bridget, your mission, should you decide to accept it, is what advice do you have for people who are entertaining?
Uh-oh. I've got four words for you. How about party from the freezer?
Okay, you've got my attention. Explain.
All right. You don't have to put on your coat and your mittens and your hat. This is all about having food ready to come out of the freezer. All the work's been done pretty much all the way to the end. All you need to do is finish up with either cooking in the oven or on the stovetop, and you've got really great hot appetizers and hors d'oeuvres to serve to people whenever they come over. I mean, my house is like Grand Central through the holidays.
Right.
So it's really nice to have a few things already in there, and I can just whip them out, and I look like a genius.
Okay, so how do we look like a genius, or geniuses, plural?
Well, a few items I can think of hand. One is cheddar cheese coins. These are like the little cheese crackers.
Yeah.
So easy to make. If you can make a pie dough, and even if you can't make a pie dough, these are so simple. Flour, a little bit of cornstarch, some other dry ingredients, of course, shredded cheese, some spices. And then you mix them together, you cut them right in the food processor, so you don't even need to really handle it. And then you roll them out into logs, wrap them in parchment, and they go right into your freezer, and they can stay in there for a month. And then if you know people are coming over, take out one of the logs, let it thaw, slice it. Quarter-inch slices is great.
Uh-huh.
And then they bake about 25 minutes, 350 degrees, and you've got something. It's so much better than any Cheez-It or Goldfish out there.
That sounds fabulous. Okay, so also you could probably serve them at room temperature if you want to do them ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah, they'll stay room temperature for at least 3 days. Again, good luck keeping them for 3 days.
This is a golden recipe.
Yeah, and you can switch out the cheese for, you know, gorgonzola, something sharper, parmesan. It doesn't just have to be cheddar.
Okay.
So very, very easy.
What else is up your sleeve or in your freezer?
Well, I also like to bring out little appetizers that aren't necessarily holiday-centric, or at least we don't necessarily think of them as being, you know, the cranberry and the cheese and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So how's a scallion pancake sound to you?
That's a great idea. They're delicious.
I'm pretty addicted to scallion pancakes, I have to say. I love that flaky texture that they have.
Right.
They're almost like glassine with this picture of scallions underneath the surface. They're just beautiful. But it's really easy to make. It's a hot water dough, which means it's just boiling water and flour mixed together. And that boiling water prevents the flour from activating the gluten. So when you go to roll it out into a thin pancake, it's not going to snap back on you. So you roll it out and you brush it with this mixture of vegetable oil and sesame oil and, of course, a little bit more flour.
Uh-huh.
And what that does is you're going to roll up that really thin pancake into kind of a jelly roll. And then you spiral it around itself. It almost looks like a snail shell.
You know, coiled. I know what you mean, yeah.
And then you roll it out again, and that creates all these flaky layers, almost like pie crust at that point. And that can go in the freezer at that point, these little pancakes in between parchment, again, up to a month. And then when you're ready to cook them, they thaw almost instantly. You just heat up a skillet. Cast iron is best for this because it gets it super crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Cut a little slit right in the middle of the pancake and cook them for about a minute to a minute and a half each side. And then you are golden. A little bit of a soy sauce and sesame oil and honey to dip it in. Perfect.
And the scallions go in after you've done that first roll, right?
That's right. I should have mentioned the scallions.
No, but this is really lovely because we are used to so many, in quotes, Western foods that go with the holidays. And these are so delicious. One more. Just one more.
Chicken empanadas. And these are, you know, the little turnovers, and we're going to make them super tiny, filled with a no-cook chicken mixture. So you don't even have to make that chicken mixture ahead of time. You can, if you have leftover chicken, that's great. If not, go ahead and get a rotisserie chicken and shred it. So you're going to use shredded chicken. You're
right.
Going to use shredded cheddar, some green olives, cilantro, lime juice, a little bit of spice in there, maybe a little bit of chipotle.
Mm-hmm.
And mix that together. And then for the dough, we're not going to make a dough. We're going to use ready-made pie dough. So you just take a little cookie
you
cutter.
You are sneaky. You really are.
Take a little cookie cutter, about, you know, 3 1/4, 3 1/2 inches
right.
round. You're going to cut a whole bunch of circles out of that. Fill each one of those circles, a couple teaspoons of the filling, and crimp and seal. And they go on a sheet pan lined with parchment into the freezer until they're rock hard. After that, you can peel them off the parchment and put them in a Ziploc bag if you'd like to. And again, they'll stay in there for a month. And then when you're ready to serve, 425, about 25 minutes, serve them with some homemade salsa, or if you have a favorite jarred salsa that's already made for you, that's even better.
Bridget, you have a great holiday, and thank you for this. This is a lifesaver.
Lynn, happy holidays to you.
Thanks.
Come on, baby, and be my guest. Come join the party and meet the rest. Everything's gonna be all right, so be my guest tonight.
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen television show. Now, you can find all those recipes Bridget talked about on our website, splendidtable.org.
It's a special party just for you. Don't let me down.
You know those dinner parties that just sail? Yeah, the food was great, the table, and the music, and the wine. But truthfully, when you really parse it out, it was how everyone talked to each other. Well, with that in mind, we've asked humorist and writer Henry Alford to help us strategize about what and why and how to make the conversation flow this holiday season. Henry is the author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? And he joins us today from New York. Henry, it's your annual visit. Welcome back.
It's true. Hello, hello.
So, okay. Everybody deals with this. You've got the family sitting around the table or friends. How do you get a conversation started?
It feels so geeky to have, you know, pre-thought of conversational prompts, but why not do it? You know, it's a terrific way to get people talking. A question that I love to ask someone whenever I reach a conversational impasse is, what do you wish you were doing more of in your life?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
It sort of puts aside the, and what do you do for a living kind of thing?
Exactly. And essentially, you're looking for questions that are, you know, personal, but not potentially humiliating. You know, there's a long history of these kinds of conversational prompts. Someone like Nora Ephron used to go around the table whenever she had a dinner party, and she would say, describe your childhood home.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah. And again, can lead in a lot of different directions.
Exactly.
In terms of getting to know each other.
Right. And I think what you're trying to avoid is something like, to use another example, is Bob Fosse used to ask people, if this were the last day of your life, what would you say?
Oh, that one. No, no.
Yeah,
oh,
we don't really want to hear the answer to that.
No, we don't. This is great. Some other thoughts?
So you could ask, what was the most helpful invention of the past 100 years and what was the most destructive invention?
So for you, what's some of the best conversations you've ever been in the midst of and how did they come about?
Well, that thing about what do you wish you were doing more of in your life, that has led to a couple of really terrific ones for me. The other thing that really helps me is before I go to a family gathering, I will turn to my boyfriend who has much better institutional memory and I will say, where does my nephew go to college? Because I can't remember. Half the challenge of the holidays 2016 is negotiating this slippery slope of political imbalances that you may have amongst your group. The other half of it, though, is build your community. Love your people. Love them harder than you've ever loved them before. And that starts with knowing that your nephew is 30 years old and graduated from Tulane 7 years ago.
How's your senior year?
Exactly.
He looks awfully mature, but I think he's still... That's a really good point because, one of the things that I don't think we think about... And maybe this is crass. Tell me what you think. When I know I'm going to be in a social situation, maybe it's business or whatever, with people I really don't know, I look them up.
Beforehand, Googling. I think that's totally allowable. I love it. And yeah, and you know about that lawsuit that you don't want to bring up.
Yeah.
No, I love it. Absolutely. I think you don't want to Google someone before you go on a date with them. But I think any kind of business meeting or even, a family gathering where someone's bringing a new person, why not?
I'm going to flip the tables here. When you're the new person... And, you don't really know anybody. You're either at a family gathering, you're at one of those holiday parties, where you look around the room and there's nobody that you know. But sitting at the table is the hardest part. What do you do? How do you kind of integrate yourself? How do you get maybe the ball rolling too?
Well, you got to pipe up. And I think a really time-honored thing is to self-deprecate somehow, just to let people know that you are vulnerable and flawed just like everyone else, and therefore please don't be scared by the fact that you don't know anything about me.
That's a really great idea, and I don't think we think about that. I think the instinct is to let people know, I'm this person, as opposed to taking that slightly, just stepping that to the side.
Exactly.
Henry, great advice. Thank you. And have a great holiday.
You too. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Henry Alford is the author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? Now, you can find a quick list of some of Henry's conversation starters on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a vegetarian blowout meal with America's Test Kitchen's Jack Bishop. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to a holiday special with America's Test Kitchen from the Splendid Table. This is APM, American Public Media. This is the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, happy holidays, everybody. We're taking eating and drinking and gifting full on today with help from our friends at America's Test Kitchen. Lisa McManus is up next. Now, she leads the team that reviews kitchen gear and supermarket ingredients at America's Test Kitchen. Lisa, great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Well, now, you test all this stuff all year round. So what have you got for this time of year?
Oh, we have so many things that we've looked at, but I brought a small selection of a few things that we thought were a little wacky, but they actually work.
So where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with something that I really love. It's called the OXO Good Grips Ratcheting Pineapple Slicer. Now, it sounds a little crazy.
It does.
But, and yes, you can just cut up a pineapple with a chef's knife, but it's a big job if you like fresh pineapple, which is so great. It's a big job. They're prickly. They're big. They're messy. This thing cuts right through a pineapple, slices it, cores it, turns it into rings. You can cut those up into smaller pieces if you want. And then you get this nice hollow pineapple that just begs to be filled with a piña colada. So it's so much fun. It's so easy. I can just do one for you right now. I've got a pineapple.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, and I've got one in front of me so we can do them together. This looks like it's a stainless steel hollow cylinder, it feels like. And it's got a substantial handle on top. And then it has sort of it's like two opposing blades. You shove it into the center of the pineapple, and then what?
You line up the core with this round part at the bottom and has teeth on it.
Right.
And that's going to take the core out. And then it has what you can hear a little clicking. Yeah. It's a ratcheting handle.
Oh, yeah.
So you just put that on there.
Right.
And it turns itself and goes right down through the pineapple.
Holy cow. Wait a minute.
Is this awesome or what?
It is
so
awesome because it's not cutting through the skin. So you're right. I'm going to get a cup out of it or a bucket.
Oh, this is only takes a couple seconds.
This is fabulous. And you know what? From what I'm looking at here, you get perfect rings, but they're going to be in a spiral?
Yes, one big spiral. And you can cut those up. And it's so great because you don't get any of those prickly bits around the edges that don't feel good.
Yeah. I'm ratcheting.
Yep.
I'm ratcheting.
Here we go.
And my pineapple is foaming at the core.
And when you're done ratcheting, you give it a little pull.
Yeah.
And it's like pulling a cork. Comes right out.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that awesome?
It is fabulous.
It looks like a big pineapple slinky.
It does. It's great. Okay. Oh, all right. Now I'm primed. What's next?
Well, the next thing is really great. It is called the Recipe Rock.
Oh, this is a very strange... This is a red thing that...
Yes. It comes in different colors, black, gray, red, whatever you like. It's about 2 inches across.
Right.
It's a little heavy semicircle.
Yeah.
And then it has a little magnet in it and a stainless steel ball that sticks to it.
So you can just, this is very cool.
It doesn't take up any counter space, but you can put, if you printed out your recipes and you're cooking, I did this at Thanksgiving, I had like 3 different recipes out and they're all getting splattered with grease or getting wet because I had them near the sink or whatever. You just put the recipe up against the back of the rock, drop the little ball on the front and it props it up.
It's sort of on concave and you put the recipe in the con of the cave and then you just pop the ball on the recipe and it's holding it up.
Yeah, right. And the magnet there with the ball and everything is propped up and it takes up no space. Easy to rinse off, throw in a drawer in between cooking, and there it is. And it's only about $9.50. Great stocking stuffer.
This is great.
Yeah, it looks strange, but then you find you really use it all the time.
Okay, now I have to ask you, there is this black thing that looks like I could slice through I don't know what. Mm-hmm. And what is it?
It's called the Get Kraken Nutcracker.
Uh-huh.
It's about $45, but this thing is the be-all and end-all of nutcrackers.
Okay.
You don't have to. I'm weak, but I love nuts.
Yeah.
If I want to crack nuts, even like Brazil nuts or something,
yeah,
it's great. It uses all this leverage in the machine. You don't have to be strong. It does the work for you.
Okay. I've put a nut under the bar.
Right. You just lift up the lever.
I lift it up.
Push it down.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that amazing?
That's really fabulous.
A whole pound of walnuts in 9 minutes flat.
Holy cow.
And it doesn't spray all the shells everywhere, and the nut meats stay intact. It doesn't smash them to smithereens. It's really nice.
Also, it's great looking. It's industrial strength
style. It's like black powder-coated steel. It's very strong looking. Appeals to, like, engineers.
Okay, now I found another puzzling thing.
What's that?
Is this thing that looks a little bit like a gun. You know, like
yes.
It might be a water gun or something.
It's called the Swing Away Jar Opener from Amco. Now, again, like I said, I'm a wimp. I have a terrible time opening jars.
Right.
I usually try to, you know, whine at my husband, can you open this for me? This, I don't even have to bother him. I can be macho all by myself opening anything. It adjusts. It's about an 8-inch length of steel with little holes in it. And that lets you set it to different widths.
So you can ratchet it, essentially.
You can ratchet it. You basically link it, put it right on top of the jar.
I've got a jar.
Make it to the size you need.
Uh-huh.
And then you squeeze that handle.
Yeah, there's a handle,
right. And you can hear a little pop. And then you just turn that lid. It comes right off.
I love this. This
isn't that
good.
Great? It's old-fashioned.
Really,
it's an oldie but a goodie.
I like that. I have a feeling not one of these would be an expected stocking stuffer.
I don't think most people have ever heard of these things, but they all serve a purpose. They do it really well. They're all inexpensive, and they're a lot of fun for people who really loved food and cooking.
Perfect idea for a gift. Lisa, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lisa McManus is executive editor for Testings and Tastings at America's Test Kitchen. Now you can find Lisa's gadget picks on the website, splendidtable.org. If you've been flipping through magazines and cookbooks and blogs, eyeing ideas for a blowout feast, look no further. How about a showstopper that can mostly be made ahead and is coincidentally vegetarian? Jack Bishop leads the creative team at America's Test Kitchen and is the author of 7 cookbooks, including A Year in a Vegetarian Kitchen. He is a man who knows how to throw a bash. Jack, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Nice to be with you, Lynn.
You know, of all the questions we get on this show, the thing I hear most from people is that they struggle with how to put together a vegetarian menu, especially for a special meal. So how do you do that?
You know, I do this pretty much by default. Went from the occasional vegetarian to anytime I'm planning a large gathering, I'm pretty much assuming that there's going to be a vegetarian there. And so I think the problem that people have is they want to replace that hunk of protein at the center of the plate with something else. And honestly, that's not the best way to create a great menu. It's about contrasting colors, textures, and that the sum of all of the parts, and the parts are going to be more equal in a vegetarian menu, is what creates a memorable meal that people will be talking about and asking for the next time they come over to your house.
I think that's an incredibly important point that I've not heard stated that clearly or stated at all, that the point is not substitute the meat. The point is it's a menu and it has to have all the things that a great menu has, which is what you described. So,
right.
Can you give us an example? You knew I was going to ask that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's about pacing, too. So I love to do a seated first course. You know, I think it's just a nice way, especially for a holiday meal. I might start off with cheese and olives, or if I'm going to do something a little more elegant, I might marinate some feta with some green olives and some lovely spices that I've made my homemade marinade. But that's really just to keep people occupied while we're taking coats, waiting for everybody to arrive. What I really want to do is gather everyone around the table, and I want something absolutely stunning and totally simple for the cook mm-hmm. for that first course. Because I don't want to be running around the kitchen for that first course. I always do soup. And I think this is the creamy beginning. And what I love is I do a creamy cauliflower soup that has no dairy, has no cream. The cream comes basically, the texture is coming from the cauliflower itself. Ah. It's a pureed soup. And the best part about this is it's just cauliflower and leeks, water, salt and pepper, and then you brown a couple of florets. You reserve about a cup of little teeny florets, brown them in butter, and then you toss them with a little sherry vinegar and you drizzle the brown butter and a little crispy florets are almost like croutons. It is a gorgeous work of art. You know, it's kind of a white on white start. Mm. It's a wonderful holiday recipe to get the party going.
And it sounds easy and you probably can do it all ahead.
You can do it 3 days ahead. You do need to brown those little florets at the last minute, but the soup is done 3 days in advance, reheating on the back burner, a half hour before everybody arrives, and ladle it into bowls. And this very simple, arty presentation with the browned butter and the crispy cauliflower florets.
It sounds delicious. I love to do that kind of thing with vegetables. So what do you follow this with? It sounds like you're kind of building this.
So this is the simple start. And then I want an abundant main plate that has lots of colors and lots of textures. And so a mushroom galette, it's pastry. Who doesn't like pastry? And it's mushrooms and it's got leeks and gorgonzola. And it's just absolutely gorgeous. You get a nice wedge of that. And then I balance it with 2 salads. One warm and one at room temperature. The warm one is with roasted butternut squash, and the room temperature one is with kale and shredded Brussels sprouts. And they have very different flavors, very different textures, the colors. And it's kind of a symphony of all the things that we love about wintertime cooking.
That galette is a shallow tart, essentially.
So, you know, think back to summer when you're taking those beautiful peaches and you're just tossing them on a round of dough and then folding up the sides, leaving most of the fruit exposed. So here, the filling is shiitake mushrooms. Now, the big issue with shiitake mushrooms is there's a lot of liquid. We actually microwave the mushrooms to get rid of the liquid, drain them in a colander because they're going to brown in the oven. We didn't really want to get them over-browned and tough. We then have cooked leeks, a little bit of thyme, a very little bit of creme fraiche and Dijon mustard, and then a sprinkling of gorgonzola. And all of that gets piled into the center of this pastry dough, and you actually assemble the tart on the baking sheet. So there's no complicated moving.
Right, right.
You know, it's a big tart. It's going to serve probably 4 to 6 people.
And then you've got the Brussels sprouts and you've got the kale slaw. But what about dessert?
So dessert, I love something kind of restrained. You know, you could go for something chocolatey and some complicated confection. And a lot of people who will build a menu want it to all be about dessert. But for me, it's really when I'm doing a vegetarian menu, it's about that main course. And so I do an almond cake. It's just super dense, single layer cake that you do in a springform pan. It's made in the food processor, which I love, so that you grind the nuts. You're making almond flour from toasted, blanched, sliced almonds. And it's just a very rich, very dense, you know, the kind of cake you would serve with a little demi-tasse of espresso or some really nice tea. You might embellish it with some whipped cream. But the cake is so moist and rich, it doesn't need frosting, doesn't need confection or sugar. It's kind of perfect as is.
This is leaving me with such a wonderful image. I can't tell you. Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all.
My favorite. Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer of America's Test Kitchen, and you can find all the recipes for that blowout feast at splendidtable.org.
My vegetables, I love you most of all.
My favorite vegetables. The new year is ahead, and with it comes all kinds of opportunities to recalibrate your life with food. Some people like to pick a cookbook and work their way through it. Some people like to take things out of their diets. And then there are some, like the man who heads up the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen, Tucker Shaw. You see, he focuses on what he's going to add to his pantry in the new year. Tucker, good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, the big question, what's on the list for 2017?
So there's nothing new under the sun, and also everything's new under the sun. And one thing that we are really hoping will finally have the moment it feels like it's been due for so long in home kitchens in America is farro. And I think probably nobody knows more about farro than you.
I don't think that's true. But I have had my moment.
We see it in restaurants quite frequently, but it's sort of been sort of teetering on the edge of home cooking in the United States for a while. And there's nothing new about it. It's a very ancient grain. But to me, it feels like a very sort of friendly grain for the grain newbie, in a sense. It's sort of an entry-level whole grain to cook. In my mind, it's very easy to cook, and it has such a wonderful, lovely, nutty, roasty, natural flavor that takes seasoning and takes additions so beautifully. And it's really kind of hard to screw it up in the kitchen.
I agree with you. It's and it has a lightness to it as well, lighter than regular wheat.
I find that farro is a really great grain to serve to somebody who professes to dislike grains, or perhaps they've been, you know, scarred by a bad wheat berry experience from, you know, several decades ago. But we call to cook it in using a pasta method. So you use a couple of quarts of well-salted water and just boil it for about 20 minutes and strain it, and you're ready to go. And you serve it warm, or you cool it down and serve it room temperature. Toss it with ingredients, pancetta maybe, a little bit of cheese, vegetables, parsley, all that kind of thing.
You know the other thing? Anything you can put on pasta, you can toss with farro.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And you can make a risotto with it, or you can use it with, I don't know, seasonings from India, for instance. It can, it can take anything that rice can take. Maybe that's a better way to put it. Don't you think that anything rice can take, farro can take?
Certainly.
So what's next on the list?
So we have been busy in the kitchen working on a book that we'll have out later in the spring that's focused on vegan cooking. So in our sort of pursuit of a butter substitute that makes sense, we tried pretty much everything we could think of and landed on coconut oil as being our favorite substitution for butter. And part of the reason for that is it is fully saturated fat, much like butter. So this is not your sort of lighter version of a fat to use for cooking. But it behaves quite a bit like butter in that it's fairly solid at room temperature. Once it gets over about 75 degrees, it may start to melt.
Uh-huh.
But you can cut it into flour in the same way that you would do for biscuits or something like that. So it behaves very, very similarly that way. And if you choose the refined coconut rather than the virgin coconut oil, it won't impart a flavor. So that allows you to sort of be in control of the flavors that come out.
The flavor's pretty swell, though. I mean, if you want to have coconut flavor, it's really quite delicious.
I agree.
Yeah.
And there's something lovely about coconut is so hot right now.
I know.
I mean,
I know. Everybody's into
everything.
It, which is kind of, like, from what I understand, a good thing. And I think for people who are not eating anything from an animal, this is a godsend. So number three.
Number three, and this is my favorite one. And this surprises me to say that because I was deeply suspicious of oat milk.
What?
Oat
All right,
milk.
I know it exists, but come on, nobody's ever talked about oat milk.
It's true. And I mean, just imagine trying to milk those little grains.
It's very hard.
So oat milk is, again, it's for somebody that's already decided not to use animal products for one reason or another, or perhaps they have a lactose intolerance, that kind of thing. But oat milk is made by soaking oats in water. You know, you sort of have to break them down a little bit, maybe blitz them, soak them in water, and then you sort of, you know, filter that. I don't even want to call it a liquid when you see it. It's sort of a mash. And then you filter that out and extract the liquid, and then you have oat milk. Now, we've tried this in the kitchen, and it's a big mess, so you're much better off purchasing it at the store. But the reason that we like oat milk, especially for baking, is that it has a rather high sugar content, which other alternatives like soy milk, coconut milk, almond milk don't have. So that you get a nice sweetness that comes through the baked goods, but it also gives you those lovely browned, lightly crisp edges.
Oh, well, I happen, just happen, to have some here. And
what do you know? So do I.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I have some from Pacific, which is our favorite in the test kitchen.
Well, let's taste, okay?
Let's do
it. It's creamy and beige.
Creamy and beige.
Oh, that's naturally sweet.
Isn't it?
And it's oaty, and it's very pleasant. Mm-hmm. This is really delicious. I mean, this has flavor. It's very pleasant. I could even see it kind of iced with, you know, with some peaches and that kind of thing.
I have to say it's lovely on a bowl of cereal, too.
No, I have to say maybe I'm going to try this.
My top test for any milk or milk substitute is the mustache that it leaves.
Ah.
And I found that oat milk leaves a very charming, rakish
mustache. I see. Tucker, you have opened up our eyes to new things, especially oat milk. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Happy holidays.
You too, and Happy New Year.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Tucker Shaw leads the team that works on Cook's Country at America's Test Kitchen, and you can find his pantry picks for the new year at splendidtable.org. Coming up, put down the champagne bottle, weave some bubbly options from unusual places, and what does Santa really want for his midnight snack? You may be surprised. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, I am a pushover for a glass of bubbly. It's an instant lift. It's instant celebration. Now, I'll drink it in July with hot dogs, but this is the season for popping corks.
My heart was not the one behind this amatory crime. No champagne does it every time.
But how about some alternatives to champagne? They could save you a bundle. Madeline Puckett, the award-winning wine maven behind the Wine Folly site, can tell all. Madeline, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Madeline, I'd like to talk about wines that sparkle, but that do not have the word champagne on the label. In so many words, the sparkling wines that are not made the way champagne is made and that are hopefully really good drinking for not a lot of money.
This is the secret, really, because there's so many great alternatives to champagne. And in fact, many of them are made with the same exact technique. So the first thing that I like to do when I'm talking champagne or bubbles, let's just talk bubbles in general.
Right, right.
The first thing I want to get out of the way is it's a matter of taste. What level of sweetness do you like? And there's different terms they plop on the bottle. There's brut, dry, demi-sec, do, there's variants of brut, brut nature, extra brut, there's dry, there's extra dry. And here's the kicker. The majority of all sparkling wine we find is in the brut category.
And that's very dry, right?
And that's dry. That's a dry champagne. If you want little extra more, extra super dry, bone dry, go extra brut. But the truth is, as much as we say dry is dry, dry champagne, dry sparkling wine is actually just a little bit sweet. It just has this a twinkle of sweetness to it. And so in the extra dry and dry category, if you see these bottles labeled as such, It means they're actually a little sweeter than brut. So now that we have that out of the way, let's talk about these awesome alternatives. You know, there's only so much champagne coming from champagne in the world, so that's why it costs so much. And it's certainly an excellent wine, but if you're on a budget, Cava is a Spanish sparkling wine that comes from the Penedès area of Spain around Barcelona, and it's made in the exact same with the exact same technique as champagne. It's Spanish bubbles. So when I'm looking at Cavas, they actually have a classification system that is very similar to champagne. And if you get a regular Cava, Cava Basic, it's aged for 9 months. And if you compare that to champagne, you can get a Cava Reserva, which is aged for 15 months, which is the same as basic non-vintage champagne.
Right.
So I'm always got my eyes out for Cava Reserva. And then if you really want to go for the fancy stuff, a Gran Reserva Cava, that's G-R-A-N, Gran Reserva is the most highest quality, and I think it's aged for about 30 months, which mimics that of basically vintage champagne.
Huh.
And I've saw Mas Codina and Reventos, they produce some pretty tremendous Cavas, and you can pick up a bottle of Reserva for around $16 or $17.
That's ridiculous compared to $50 or $60 for champagne.
I know.
What about South Africa? I hear so much really wonderful wine is coming out of there.
So South Africa is a fascinating region. They have one of the most unique sort of terroir, sort of soil types that are there. I mean, if you can imagine these amazing photos of South Africa around the Cape, most of the grapes grow in the Cape area, the Western Cape. And these wines, they have a predominance of Chenin Blanc growing there. And Chenin Blanc we might think of as a sweet wine, but they actually produce it in a pretty dry style. And they'll make sparkling wines with Chenin Blanc, with Chardonnay, just like they might do that in Champagne. And they have this style, Cap Classique, as they've called it, is their version of Champagne. And I've seen a couple of producers in America. Graham Beck is very well distributed. You can find it pretty much everywhere. These wines are fabulous. And Graham Beck you can pick up for about $14 to $16 a bottle. And their rosés are absolutely wonderful. So if you love rosé bubbles, South Africa is a great place to go.
This is pure gold. Now, there's something I found out a long time ago, and I thought I was so smart to figure it out, that in areas that produce very famous, very expensive wines, often if you go just beyond the area those wines come from, you will find very good wine, but at a very different price point. They'll generally be bargains. Does that exist for the Champagne district?
Actually, you know, there is a region just south of the Côte de Bar, which is the southern area in Champagne, and it's literally connected to the northern area of Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the Champagne side, they call it Champagne, but on the Burgundy side, which is, I mean, it's just a bunch of hills, on the Burgundy side, they call it Crémant de Bourgogne. And so it's made with the same grapes. They use Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, just like they would in Champagne.
Right.
And because they're all neighbors, they use the same production methods as well.
Huh.
So when you're looking at Crémant de Bourgogne, which you can get for $19 or $20 a bottle, compare that to just up north in Côte de Bar or the Aube region, it's a lot more. So this is a awesome area to find some really, really yummy. And Crémant is the what a lot of the regions in France call sparkling wine if it's not in Champagne. So if you find a Crémant de whatever, Crémant d'Alsace, Crémant de Limoux,
mm-hmm.
a Crémant Bourgogne, it is a sparkling wine. And that is a really great place to look for value.
Madeline, this is, I can't tell you, great information, and happy holidays. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Madeline Puckett is co-author of Wine Folly, The Essential Guide to Wine. You can find her sparkling wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Lancaster is back. Now, she's host of America's Test Kitchen television show. Bridget, I'm kind of surprised to see you again, and suddenly bottles have appeared in the studio? What's up?
Well, I've got some really good insider information, and that is Santa's a beer drinker. I mean, check out that belly. We all know it. No more cookies and milk. We're going to put out beer and some snacks for Santa. And I asked his elves to ship you some of my homebrew. So that's what you have there in front of you. I also have one commercially made beer for you as well. And we can set out pairings of food and beer. And let's start off with an IPA or an India Pale Ale. So that is a beer that's pretty heavily hopped. It has a lot of, it's an ale. It has a lot of nice, round, malty flavor, but it also has quite a bit of hops. And hops are a type of, it's almost like an herb, if you think about mm-hmm. it. They add different profiles to different types of beer. A little bit of a floral taste. IPA, as I said, it was an India Pale Ale, and so it naturally pairs well with spicy food. So not just food from India, but you could think of Mexican food. You could put out chips and salsa. Would be great uh-huh. for Santa with an uh-huh. IPA. I like to do spiced nuts with some cardamom and some cayenne, something really nice and spicy and easy. You should also have a Kolsch there. That's my Kringle Kolsch. That has Santa's picture
on
it.
I've never heard of Kolsch. What is it?
So a Kolsch is also a type of ale, but unlike regular ale, which uses ale yeast, a Kolsch uses a yeast from
lagering. So that is, a lager is something that you think of a Budweiser or a Coors. Those are very simple American lagers. A Kolsch is a German-style beer that has the profile of an ale. So it has the hearty ale yeast, but has the crispness and the refreshing flavor of a Pilsner or a lager. And, you know, this is perfect for charcuterie. So put out a little plate of meats and cheeses, maybe some olives. Pickles are perfect with a Kolsch. Absolutely perfect.
This sounds like my kind of beer.
I can highly recommend it on New Year's, too, to go with a fondue. It's perfect.
Okay.
And how about a wee heavy? Now, a wee heavy is a very strange name for a beer. It's a Scottish ale, very malt forward. So it's a little bit sweet, and it's called wee heavy because it has a pretty high alcohol content. But the reindeer are driving, so we don't need to worry about Santa too much. I like to pair that with strong-flavored cheeses, something like a gorgonzola or a really, really ripe aged cheddar, because it has a very sweet flavor. So it's nice to pair it a little bit. If you think of things like balsamic vinegar and heavy cheeses or plums and heavy cheeses, think of the wee heavy as kind of that malty, syrupy, barley-forward beer that's going to be perfect with cheese.
And that's why the elves have left a wedge of gorgonzola, and I'm pouring wee heavy, which, by the way, comes in an unmarked bottle. Oh, my God, it's dark. It looks like root beer.
It does.
Let's see if it tastes like root beer. I've got a little bit of the gorgonzola. Mm, that's a nice gorgonzola.
So it's interesting. A lot of people will serve something like a porter or a barley wine as well with strong cheeses. They can really take that assertive flavor of the food.
This has a sweetness and a spicy quality almost. You know, I jokingly said it looks like root beer, but it has, I could almost taste vanilla and brown sugar. I mean, it's not sugar sweet, but there's that molassesy quality to it.
That's the barley. That's the malt that's made from all that really deep-flavored barley that you're tasting.
Yeah, and the gorgonzola just lights up with it.
Mm-hmm.
It cancels out a lot of the saltiness, and it brings up the richness and the creaminess of it. Okay, and then I've got one more. What's this?
Now, you should have a milk stout in front of you, and that is not one of mine. That is one of your local milk stouts. I have yet to brew a milk stout. I'm working on it. But milk stout, we all know stout, something like Guinness. Milk stout has a heavier roasted flavor, almost toasted, I would say, more than roasted. And it's a little bit sweeter. It's definitely lighter than the wee heavy. This is the perfect beer to go with a chocolate chip cookie, or pretty much any chocolate dessert.
So Santa gets a cookie. I like that.
Santa's going to get a cookie, whether he wants one or not. People always think beer and chocolate. Well, of course. The Germans and the Austrians are famous for both beer and chocolate. Do you think that they never drank and ate them together? But a milk stout has that little bit of a sweet aftertaste, and it has a gentle aroma and a gentle flavor. It's perfect to go.
I'm going to take a sip first.
Perfect.
Oh, yeah, it does. And I could just imagine chocolate, but now I'm not going to imagine. I'm going to taste chocolate chip cookie. Oh, my. This is better than wine with chocolate. Or
there
port.
You go. So it gets its name originally from the creaminess of the stout. Some makers do actually put milk flakes in their beer. So you may... every once in a while, get a milk stout that has a little bit of milk in it, but they usually do not.
Bridget, you have opened my eyes because you might know I'm not really a beer drinker. It may change in the new year. Hey, thank you. And Santa thanks you also.
Merry Christmas.
And to you.
Happy holidays!
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen television show. Now, you can find all those Santa pairings at splendidtable.org. Who knew he was a beer drinker?
Happy holidays to you.
Well, that's it for this holiday special. No matter what you're celebrating, take time to help others and to let the people you love know that they are loved. From all of us here at the Splendid Table and America's Test Kitchen, happy holidays. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace.
Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.